our model suggests that what in the past has been interpreted as a decline in birth rate may in fact have been driven by predation.
A new take on why Western Aleutian sea lion numbers are so low. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, January 20th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a panel examines the risk from Japan's tsunami debris to Alaska's coastline.
It is likely that much of the debris sank near shore.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Timing is everything. A mother who waits until her child is at least 2 years old before becoming pregnant again has a better chance of regaining strength and energy between pregnancies. Her baby is more likely to be born on time and at a good weight. So talk to your health care provider to find out how to plan your pregnancies and ask for the state's free birth spacing booklet. Take the time to build a strong and healthy family. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
A 22-year-old former soldier convicted of killing his wife and infant daughter will serve 80 years in prison. Kip Lynch was sentenced today in the killing of his 19-year-old wife Raquel and daughter 8-month-old Kirsta in April 2010. Prosecutors say the murders were premeditated and Lynch stood over his wife and daughter and fired additional rounds. But the defense argued Lynch was suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. Lynch survived a suicide attempt but was badly injured. The killings took place about 2 months after Lynch had returned from a year-long deployment in Afghanistan. Federal Judge Timothy Burgess ruled yesterday that the National Marine Fisheries Service may have cut some regulatory corners in ordering a costly closure of the Atka mackerel and Pacific cod fisheries in the Western Aleutians, but he stopped short of reversing the order. Judge Burgess said in his ruling that judges are not scientists and he would defer to scientific expertise. APRN's Steve Heimel reports on one scientist who says the experts might be wrong.
An Oregon State University researcher is raising some new scientific doubts about the sea lion biological opinion. Marcus Horning has been tagging sea lions at the Seward Sea Life Center and releasing them in Prince William Sound using a new kind of tag that senses temperature and light. The tag stores this data and transmits it when the sea otter dies. Lately, the tags have been going dark.
Recently, we got some data returns from tags that we think were ingested by an animal, by a predator. And that's because the tags saw this almost instantaneous temperature drop, but they didn't see any light and they didn't sense any air. And the only way that could happen is if the tag was swallowed by the predator.
Those predators would be killer whales and sharks. And they prefer young sea lions. Of the 36 juvenile sea lions he's tagged and released in Prince William Sound, 14 have died and 13 of those were eaten. In a study released at this week's Marine Science Symposium in Anchorage, Horning took that information and applied it to the non-recovering Aleutian sea lions, which have been found to be in jeopardy from lack of food. He stresses that he is only working with data already compiled.
So the same data that past models have used, but we analyze it and look at it in a different way, and lo and behold, our model suggests that what in the past has been interpreted as a decline in birth rate may in fact have been driven by predation. It's important to remember that all of these are models that we're talking about, so they're somewhat speculative, including past models. So the past models that have suggested a decline in birth rate are models, and those suggestions or hypotheses have never been tested.
When animal populations are held down by predators, it's referred to by biologists as a predator pit. Dr. Horning says this situation is a little different. He calls it a productivity pit, driven by predation.
What we think is happening is that the predators focus on young sea lions, and because they focus on young sea lions, not enough of them grow up to reproduce, and not enough females grow up to have pups. And so the net result is more that too few pups are born, but it's because of the focus of predators on young animals, on juveniles.
Horning has proposed an Aleutians tagging experiment to prove which theory is right, but so far federal officials have turned him down and he's limited to Prince William Sound.
Currently we can only work here, and that's largely because of permit constraints. We would like to work out further west, But we would have to do our work in a different way.
And in a more expensive way, with a large laboratory on board a ship and tanks capable of holding the tagged animals for observation for an extended period to make sure they're okay when they're released. After all, they are endangered. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
It's been nearly a year since an earthquake in Japan triggered a tsunami that devastated whole communities in that country's northwest area. Debris was swept out to sea, and much of it is still afloat and being carried by currents across the Pacific. Some of it has already reached Alaska's coast, but how much more can we expect? And will the debris be contaminated with radiation from the damaged Fukushima nuclear facility? SKSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports Senator Lisa Murkowski wants answers on the wreckage that may be heading our way.
The bulk of the debris is not expected to hit the U.S. West Coast before 2013, but already stuff is washing up on shore in our state. Senator Lisa Murkowski moderated a panel of state and federal officials on Friday at the University of Alaska in Anchorage to find out just how the wreckage is tracked and what plans are being made to deal with it.
There's a lot of speculation, and my hope is to hear from some of those who are spending the time and the energy better understanding what impacts we may see here on Alaska's coastline.
Murkowski first introduced Japan's consul in Anchorage, Mr. Hideo Fujita, who told the group that Japanese ocean policy officials share information with the U.S. and that his country's studies have found that the issue of radioactive contamination is lessening.
We think that possibility is very small.
Consul Fujita said that the radioactive properties are water-soluble and likely reduced in intensity to low levels. He said Japanese officials have estimated that more than 20 million tons of debris resulted from the disaster. But much of that lies on Japan's shores, and much of what was washed out to sea has likely sunk to the bottom of the ocean. Kristen Ryan, director of environmental health with the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, confirmed that risks associated with radiation are low. Ryan said three radioactive isotopes concern scientists: iodine, cesium-134, and cesium-137. Because they could contaminate food sources.
We worked with the Environmental Protection Agency, NOAA, FDA, to decide if there were any risks to Alaskan fisheries and wild foods or human health to a degree. And from what we found from the data that's available, the answer is no. There is no concern to us that there is any radiation impacts in Alaska to our environment that we should be worried about at this time.
Ryan said EPA air quality monitoring sites in Alaska detected only elevated levels of cesium in Dutch Harbor after the disaster, and those levels were still too low to be of concern. Peter Murphy, representing NOAA, said the tsunami wave reached a height of 130 feet at its highest point. Murphy said the loss of life, more than 15,000 dead and many thousands more missing or homeless, was first of all a human tragedy. NOAA estimates there was about 25 million tons of debris, although that was created on land. But what went into the water could be anything and everything, Murphy said. He said large bands of debris, like what was photographed in the days after the disaster, disperse after a few days.
It is likely that much of the debris sank near shore in the first few miles offshore. This is backed up by our experiences with Hurricane Katrina. Also, debris is dispersed and not in large patches. Debris tends to spread out. The computer models predictions, northwestern Hawaiian Islands, those areas would receive tsunami debris first as early as this winter, as then moving on to the west coast of North America, which includes southeast Alaska, and then as debris enters the Alaska Current or the California Current, it would circle around.
NOAA models indicate the flotsam will continue west till it splits up at the U.S. coastline, some following the California Current south, the rest following the Alaska Current north. The question is, where is the debris now? Murphy says that's a challenge when dealing with the open ocean. NOAA is working with NASA and the Department of Defense to get satellite data for starters, and working with overflights and with the shipping community to get reports of sightings. Federal and state officials plan to work with local groups on deciding the best course of action in each location. Once the debris arrives on U.S. beaches, cleanup becomes the next step. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Thank you. The corporation
is not a person.
Is not a person.
That word belongs to you and me.
That's a group of about 24 protesters in front of the federal courthouse in downtown Anchorage today. They're part of the national Move to Amend rally taking place at courthouses across the nation today and this weekend. Cindy Cairns of Eagle River helped organize the Anchorage event. She says the protest marks the second anniversary of the Citizens United Supreme Court decision.
Citizens United was a court case, a Supreme Court case ruling 2 years ago, tomorrow, that citizens, that corporations are people and money is speech. So now the corporations can make super PACs and spend as much money as they want on elections. 94% of the time, the person with the most money wins an election.
Cairns says they want an amendment to the Constitution to limit the influence of corporations on politics. The protesters say they were inspired by the Occupy Wall Street movement. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an Alaskan gets a presidential appointment to a national tourism board.
International travel is very important to Alaska. It's a growing area. We're seeing growth in countries where we really haven't been able to do any marketing.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees.
The contentious issue of antlerless moose hunts drew a large crowd to a Fairbanks Fish and Game Advisory Committee meeting last night. The committee has to decide whether or not to recommend the reauthorization of antlerless hunts in two game management areas surrounding Fairbanks. Fish and Game uses the hunts to manage the moose population and to prevent habitat damage. KUAC's Emily Schwing attended the meeting.
More than 200 people turned out to offer their opinions on the hunts. The crowd was a surprise to Fish and Game area biologist Don Young.
This hunting public that has participated in these hunts that supports them is finally knows and understands that this is an important issue, and the advisory committee is the one that makes the decision.
Antlerless moose hunts are the only instance where the advisory committee has the authority to make a game management decision. Among the public, opinions were evenly split.
My name is Tim McManus. I'm from Nenana. I'm on the Fish and Game Advisory Committee down there. I am for it. Right now, there seems to be it's working out good. I know it's a tough winter, and if you didn't get a moose this fall, you know, it's easy to go out there to get a moose in the wintertime, fill up your freezer. So I'm for it.
Yes, I'm Jackie Bailey. I live in North Pole, and my concern is the winter hunt for the cows and the concern of killing cows with calves during the winter here when they're only a couple months from calving. I'm not totally against antlerless hunt, but I'm not totally for it neither.
Between 20 and 30% of all moose harvested statewide are taken in game management units 20A and 20B. According to Don Young, the antlerless hunts have drawn strong opinions for at least a decade.
There's the emotional side, shooting females, and so on. So some hunters just have a strong ethic against that sort of thing.
Three other advisory committees in the region will also hold public meetings over the next few weeks. In February, those committees will make a recommendation to the State Board of Game. The board will make a final decision on the hunts in March. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
President Obama has appointed an Alaskan to an advisory board for U.S. travel and tourism. He chose the CEO of Alaska Wildland Adventures. As KSKA's Daisha Eaton reports, the appointment is part of a push to boost the tourism economy.
President Obama appointed Alaska Wildland Adventures CEO Kirk Hessel to the National Visitor Industry Advisory Board this week at the recommendation of Senator Mark Begich. Hessel runs the Girdwood-based adventure travel company, and he says he hopes to bring an Alaskan voice to the table.
I felt a little bit out of place at first because we're such a tiny company. I knew that there were leaders of some very large companies that were usually involved with this sort of thing, but it was very encouraging. It appears that the Secretary of Commerce went out of his way to make sure that there were lots of viewpoints represented.
Hessel's one of 32 people appointed to the board. The president is calling on the advisory board to help boost the U.S. tourism economy. His goal is job creation. Hessel says after years of developing a tourism business in Alaska that takes the environment into account, he hopes to share what he's learned.
One of the things that has always been a priority for us is to operate in a low-impact manner, a sustainable manner. As more and more people are conscious of choices they make in their lifestyles, trying to conserve energy, trying to have a lighter footprint on the earth, research has shown that more and more people are setting out to purchase vacation services that leave a lighter footprint. And I think a lot of the concepts, a lot of the lessons learned over the years in Alaska, we can share with our colleagues across the states.
Alaska's travel and tourism industry is driving more than $2 billion in spending annually and employing in excess of 40,000 people. It's doing better than the lower 48s, but Hessel says there are still challenges.
Alaska is a long distance destination for most people. Therefore, it can be expensive to get here. It takes more time. That's why we had the downturns in travel and tourism after the events of September 11th. That's why we had the downturn after, 2008, 2009, the recession. And while we have seen some growth, we're still on our way back as an industry.
One bright spot in his business over the years, Hessel says, has been an increase in international visitors. Making it easier for foreigners to visit the U.S., he says, and bring their dollars here is something President Obama touched on when he addressed the advisory board.
International travel is very important to Alaska. It's a growing area. We're seeing growth in countries where we really haven't been able to do any marketing, such as Brazil and India and Israel. I mean, people are coming anyway, and if we can help nurture these markets, it's going to benefit Alaska and benefit all of the United States.
The board had their first meeting this week in Orlando. Hessel attended and says they discussed an array of issues. Of particular interest was an update on efforts by the federal government to streamline the tourist visa process.
As I understand it, more and more employees have been added to facilitate that, training on processing and streamlining the whole visa process is something that's under the works right now, which could be a very good thing. More and more travelers, especially from some of these emerging markets such as Brazil and China.
And Hessel says he hopes he'll be seeing more and more visitors to Alaska from places like Brazil and China by the time the upcoming tourism season rolls around again in April. That's right around the time he says he'll meet again with the National Visitor Industry Advisory Board in Los Angeles. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the statewide BP Teachers of Excellence program. Nomination forms are available at bpteachers.com. Nominations are due by February 14th. Rasmussen Foundation announces a March 1st deadline to apply for individual artist awards, which provide funding directly to artists to support their creative work. Learn more by participating in one of their informational teleconferences to be held in January. Visit Rasmussen Foundation on Facebook or on the web at rasmussen.org for more information. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
Ketchikan, Kotzebue,
Dillingham, Sitka, Chugia,
Fairbanks, Fort Yukon, Wrangell,
Barrow, Unalaska, Dutch Harbor, Alaknarechmute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Steve Heimel. This week on AK, finding inspiration in Alaska. Singer-songwriter Jeff Kanzler first came to Alaska a decade ago to visit a lovely Alaskan girl. They didn't end up together, but he still considers her to be something of his angel in life for introducing him to the last frontier. A few years back, Jeff moved to Vashon Island near Seattle to be close to family, but a recent Alaska tour had him reminiscing about what inspired some songs he wrote. He told Laurie Neufeld about the tune Angel, which was written during an early adventure in interior Alaska. He was living and working at a remote tourist destination at the very end of the Denali Park Road.
I'll play a tune that I wrote in Alaska. It's one that I wrote early on when I was working out at Camp Denali.
I thought I might once trouble you, share what came upon me in this dream I had.
A recent visit to the KUAC Fairbanks studios during his Alaska tour had Jeff reflecting on where and when he wrote some of these songs. And he certainly has a quirky sense of humor about sharing or even oversharing a few tunes.
I had gone out there to work, and I had written two songs, that one and Crack Country Livin', which is on Blacktop Road. And I'm pretty sure that the people who worked there at the time still don't want to hear either of those two songs. Me and the few people that I was playing out there with that summer, that was all we played, those two songs. Maybe a couple covers, so I just wanted to dust that one off. I won't play Blacktop Road today, I promise.
My crack country living is calling her now from over the hills.
You know, you may be influenced by a little bit of Led Zeppelin in there, a little bit of Beatles. I know, especially, you know, when you're rocking out with a band, it sounds like that to me. And, well, I've heard you do a cover, too, of some Zeppelin and some Beatles.
I mean, those are pretty, you know, they're kind of touchstones. It's not just even the influence side of it and what you like. There's that soundtrack of your life thing. I grew up in Renton, Washington, which... classic rock is what was on. I didn't really hear bluegrass until I came to Alaska. The closest thing to bluegrass I had heard was the song Hot Dog by Led Zeppelin, which was basically their electrified version of a bluegrass song.
So it wasn't until coming to Alaska a dozen years ago and spending some time here that you heard bluegrass. That's
yeah, I moved to just about the northernmost city in the world to be introduced to a very southern Appalachian based art form. So it was interesting. But what a great place to be introduced to it, you know.
There's this one song, if Jeff Kanzler had a single, this would probably be it. It leads off his Blacktop Road CD. People that have seen Jeff play a gig know it.
I'm still, even the other night, the request for Angelina, so I thought I'd do an acoustic version of Angelina. Just to, you know, this might be the last time. This might be it. Putting Angelina to bed right now. We're putting Angelina to bed. She will not be woken up again.
Oh, Angelina. Sadly, you have wasted here so long. Carried on a question, you were stranded. You turned to catch ship already gone. Oh, what an answer. Anytime them letters cross the sea. Carried on the ocean like a baby. They carried on the water and the breeze.
I still like that song.
You know, I wrote that song out on Stampede Road. Well, beautiful evening, I was traveling north with a friend and we just decided to camp out there on our way to Fairbanks. And so I like it too. But I do every time I come to play, I'm like, well, you play Angelina? Well, yeah, probably Angelina because, well, you know, got one album out. There's 12, I don't know how many songs, 11, 12 songs on it.
Yep.
And yeah, that's one of them. So chances are I'm going to play Angelina. That's it though.
Alaska, the people and the place is close to Jeff Kanzler's heart. It could even be called his muse, and probably has shaped his sense of humor too.
Yeah, them northern winds, they might make the mountains spin.
In Fairbanks, for AK, I'm Lori Neufeld.
They'll never push your head any closer to your heart. No, they'll never push your head any closer to your heart.
And now it's time for 300 Villages. This week we visit Tok on the Alaska Highway to find out just what folks there do during the deep freeze of winter while we delve into the mystery of how Tok got its name.
I'm John Rushniak from Tok, Alaska, owner of Log Cabin Wilderness Lodge, and currently the president of the Tok Chamber of Commerce. Well, Tok is located along the Alaska Highway on the eastern part of Alaska. As you drive up from the lower 48, Tok would be the first community you come to on the highway, and it's kind of a crossroads. You have a choice in Tok to go to either Anchorage or to Fairbanks. There's many rumors. I could tell you my favorite one, but that doesn't mean it's right. My favorite one is when the surveyors got to Tok, and the surveyor was giving his assistant some notes, and he says, we're at the T, okay? And so the assistant wrote that all down, and the T, okay, came out Tok. One of the major industries in Tok is the tourism because it is the crossroad and the only road in and out of Alaska. Anybody that drives this direction has to come through Tok. So that makes for a good economy in the summer with tourism. Well, Tok, because it is the crossroads and many people come here, there's a large number of campgrounds, RV parking, a lot of bed and breakfast and motels. There are a number of good restaurants in Tok, tons of gift shops, since people are trying to get that last souvenir before leaving the state, or as they come to the state, they're happy to spend their American money once again. Like any place, you get used to paying what the going rate is. If you're comparing prices with Barrow, no, we're not expensive. A couple of the campgrounds do have nightly entertainment, live music, through the summer months. We've got a couple of musicians that play at the different campgrounds, and that's open to the general public whether they're at that campground or not. We're 28 miles south of Tok. We operated a wilderness lodge. Years ago, when I did live right in Tok and worked for the school district, I used to bicycle at 68 below, so I'm not afraid of getting outside when it's chilly. At our lodge, we groom about 13 miles of cross-country ski trails. This Saturday, we're having what we're calling the Super Saturday. Cross-country skiing, soup, bring a sandwich to share, sauna, sizzle by the campfire, snowshoe, socialize, and we're advertising this as free, but it's sponsored by the letter S from the Sesame Street. We'd be happy to have you come and visit our area anytime you have the time in your schedule.
That was John Rushniak in Tok. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on air. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Annie Feit, Dave Waldron, Ellen Lockyer, and Lori Neufeld, host of the Alaska Live series. Audio and podcasts of Alaska Live are available at KUAC.org, including the whole interview and performance with Jeff Kanzler. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Steve Heimel.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer and Dacia Eaton in Anchorage and Emily Schwing in Fairbanks. APRN Steve Heimel reported from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2012 PFD and consider sharing a portion of your dividend through Pick, Click, Give or contributing to a college savings plan. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
And by
Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.